This is Louis Zumbaugh with Rush Hour Ag. Leave your message after the tone.
Hey, Louis, it's Elliot Anderson. Can't wait to tell you about... On the back road, she's riding with the dust, talking agriculture policy with people you can trust. From the field to the capital, we're bringing it down. Real talk, real issues from a real farm town. Every hour's rush hour when the work won't leave, so we're cutting through the noise and setting things straight. What's your rush today, Elliot?
Welcome, listeners, to the Rush Hour Ag Podcast. Thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Elliot Henderson.
And I'm your host, Louis Zumbaugh. At Rush Hour Ag, we hope to test your brain with different topics, and our main topics are policy and politics that affect you in your everyday life. Today we have a guest from the Iowa State Capitol. His name's Gary Grant. He's a lobbyist for different groups. And Gary, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, yeah, I'm a multi-client lobbyist, which means I represent multiple clients. So my business partner and I, we kind of have evolved into kind of specialist and local government issues, which includes, you know, property tax, building regulations, you know, development regulations, tax increment financing, things like that. So we deal with a variety of issues at the state capitol, and we just, you know, have a lot of fun doing it and representing our clients. Some days it's more fun than others, but it's pretty interesting. Never the same thing every day.
At Rush Hour Ag here, we try to stay on topics that have to do with agriculture, but in all honesty, when it comes to Iowa, a lot of things boil down to affecting agriculture, whether you really realize it or not, whether it's right away or down the road.
Sure.
But I know the property tax bill's been going on, and I know it's always changing,
right?
But what can you tell us what's going on with that right now?
Well, I think there's some struggle right now to – Iowa's got a fairly complicated property tax mechanism. They don't tax things directly on value, especially ag land. It's more taxed on productivity. But in your residential dwellings, even, you know, urban and rural, are taxed on a formula that includes the value of the property. And then we have something called a rollback, where you can only tax, you know, a certain percentage of the value of the structure. And I think one of the struggles is untying this is kind of a Gordian's knot, if you will, of difficulty, that how do you provide real substantial relief to the taxpayer? How do you simplify the system so that the taxpayer can actually understand what they're paying and how, you know, what is going to, like, the school districts and what's going to the township trustees, the city if you live in one, the county if you don't. Then the last one is, how do you still, because our local governments are largely sort of dependent on property taxes for revenue to fix streets, you know, sewers, to run, you know, to the schools are dependent upon them. You know, the cities use a mechanism called tax increment financing to capture land value, to add sort of incentives for developers to build things, you know, like workforce housing. I know that's being discussed about adding that to tax increment financing. And the problem is, you know, we've created kind of a, you know, large house of cards. And, you know, when you start pulling at things, how do you, like I said, provide real relief to taxpayers, make it a system they can understand, and also make it sure that local governments and county governments have the revenue they need to plow the streets, to provide sewers, to fix potholes, things like that. So I think we've had two iterations of a bill coming out of the Ways and Means Committee, which, you know, if you hear different committee names, Ways and Means basically crafts all the tax policy. So on a state level, same as on a federal level, they they craft the tax policy. And I think one of the things, or not one, but several of the things they're struggling with is when you start to move some of these pieces, it'll have an effect on other classes of property. So if you roll, if you eliminate like the rollback, maybe that puts more of a burden on the homeowner. If you remove, you know, sort of another piece, does it affect the tax rate of ag land? And I think that's what they're struggling with right now. So right now, I'm not sure that they've advanced to a, you know, the couple of first two versions of the bill are public, but I don't know that they've advanced to a place where they're happy with that it provides the three things I mentioned. Again, they're the, you know, the real relief to taxpayers of all classes, not just, you know, urban, but rural, ag land, you know, commercial, industrial, residential. How do you make it simple so people can understand what it, where it is their money's going? And how do you not sort of affect the things that are going on, like school districts and things like that? So it's a struggle, and I think it'll take a while.
I know it's been a really hot button issue there from up in Independence. You know, them towns the size of 5,000 to 7,000 people living in them. There's just a real burden on those communities with the way that they've set up the current property tax system.
Yes, the one of the issues, that's one of the issues they're struggling with, because Iowa, there are pockets of Iowa that are growing, but that's not true everywhere. And some of our small towns and rural areas that aren't growing, we currently have kind of a, when they changed it, you know, a couple of years ago, they limited revenue based on growth. So if you grow, if you have, you know, X percent growth, you're allowed to grow the revenue of your town. You know, through property that you levy through property taxes, X amount. So, and it's kind of a complicated formula. But the problem you run into with those kinds of approaches are most of our rural areas aren't growing. So use your example, like Independence, that, and I don't know if they're growing, but let's just say for the sake of argument that they're not. So just like as farmers, you know, you pay, you know, more than you did last year for seed, and more than you did last year for fertilizer, and more than you did last year for fuel. Small towns are kind of in the same boat. They're paying more for fuel for the vehicles to plow the roads. You know, they're paying more for health insurance. They're paying more for, you know, plywood. You know, like we all saw, you know, after natural disasters, the price of building materials goes up. So when you have increasing costs, which everybody does year over year, and, you know, hopefully we don't see, you know, 8, 9, 10% inflation like we did a few years ago. But even if you're seeing 3, 4% inflation, which would be fairly in the normal range of what it would be, if your revenues are growing by zero, but your expenses are growing by 4% a year, it doesn't take very long before you start running into areas where you can't provide some of the things that the residents expect. So nobody likes to pay property taxes. It's, you know, that's when, so when, you know, the legislators, they'll say, you know, we hear about property taxes. So, and as somebody that represents some municipal governments, what I think we're running into is if I'm running for city council and I knock on your door and I say, you know, hey, tell me, you know, I'm interested in, you know, what are you looking for your city council member? They'll say, well, I want more parks. I want you to mow the park we have more often. I want you to fix the potholes in my street. And, you know, I think you should plow the streets, you know, more than once after a snowstorm. Okay. So I knock on that same door, you know, and I say, hey, I'm running for state legislature. You know, why don't you talk to me about your issues? And or they'll say, you know, you think your property taxes are too high? And they'll say, hell yeah, my property taxes are too high. Cut my property taxes. Well, at some point, something's got to give, because we all want to pay less and get more. everybody in every line of work, you know, from, you know, a farmer to a somebody that owns a factory, that we'd all love to pay less for our inputs and get more for our outputs. But that's not always the way things work. And that's another challenge, I think, with property taxes is I think we saw that it affects maybe some rural areas more than they thought it was going to when they enacted the bill. And I think that's another balancing act I think they have to take a look at, because we all want all of our communities, big and small, to be successful, because that's how, as a state, we're successful. But if we can't pass something that, you know, helps everybody, that disadvantages, you know, people in the rural areas, because the areas that in Iowa that are growing will most likely continue to grow. Maybe not as fast, you know, some years as in others, but we have a real challenge with our rural communities.
As someone that has had several different jobs, I've been in the Iowa House and as county supervisor both, and I also live in a little corner of the world that I live in the midst of three counties within a mile of my house. So I often looked at state government as being local government somewhat. And I know your local county supervisors don't like it when the state comes in and does certain things. But has anybody ever thought of because I do, and I didn't come from Linn County, and we didn't have a money issue when we had to take some money back out of the budget 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that painful for the county. And in fact, the next year it was all given back with the transportation bill that was passed, mm-hmm. treasurer's bill. So has anybody ever thought of the state actually giving a list of these are the things the county can actually tax or actually pay for, should be paying for? Because I know in Linn mm-hmm. County, we have funds that we give to a lot of things that we wouldn't have to. It isn't running the government. It isn't running county government. It's, for instance, you know, mental health, the state took it over. We still pay some things mental health from the county, our countywide, I feel the state should have took them over too, but hadn't been asked to at that point. Has that ever been considered?
Well, I think the problem is that I think lots of things like that are considered. The issue is that, you know, there are things that maybe, you know, you don't think the county should pay for, don't think the county should be responsible for, but maybe somebody else thinks that those are essential services. So we have kind of categories of expenditures, and you know this, remember this from a county supervisor, your county supervisor role. There are, and I don't know if they're called exactly this, but there are essential services and then permissible services. So most of the levies that you have right now, and I'll just use counties as an example, they are limited in what they can pay for, with the exception of like the general and maybe the supplemental. But they have things that you can pay for with them and things that you can't pay for. And like the rural services levy, you couldn't take the rural services levy and pay for, like in Linn County, you couldn't take the rural services levy and pay for a paving project in, say, Coggin, in the city limits. So there are things like that in effect now. But if you start to more closely define those, you run into a situation where, you know, the voters of Linn County, you know, county supervisors being elected officials have a constituency to answer to. And they're kind of the final, they should be, in my opinion, the final say over what the county spends its money on. And even if there are always going to be people that think we should be spending more on this and less on this or nothing on this. So I think those decisions are probably better made at a local level than they are at a state level.
You got me thinking about this, you know, a lot of this absentee landlords in the farming world, you know, a lot of this. These rent checks, you know, like Buchanan County, for instance, there's 27,000 acres now owned by people that don't live in the state of Iowa.
Sure.
So a lot of that revenue coming that's produced from that land is leaving these communities, where in the past it used to circulate inside these communities. You know, is there any conversations that are being addressed to handle that issue?
You know, I none that I've heard of. I mean, I think people sort of recognize that that's becoming you know, increasingly popular, because, you know, we've seen, you know, over the past 10 years, kind of, and I don't know that I would say explosion, but for lack of a better word, an explosion in the value of Iowa farmland. So there are more, I think it would be safe to say that there are probably more people that own Iowa farmland now that don't live in Iowa or don't live where it is than probably at any time kind of in the last generation.
Through inheritance money printing, there's been a demand or a drive to buy land in Iowa.
Well, and I think with the differing, and I'm no expert in this, but I'm just speculating that with the difference in after COVID, we saw that a lot of businesses, you know, didn't think they needed as much office space as they were maintaining. So let's say, for the sake of argument, that I own a small business or a small, you know, office building or office park in say Chicago, and I know that my pre-COVID, you know, occupancy rate was 10%. My post-COVID occupancy rate was 40%. So I say, well, you know, Iowa farmland's going up, or Illinois farmland's going up. So I sell my, you know, my little office park and I buy, 1,000 acres of farmland in Iowa or Illinois or wherever it is. And, you know, do a 1031 exchange and just, I think that's kind of what we're seeing a little bit. In southwestern Iowa, I think there are, big tracts of timber, things like that, that are, I think, increasingly owned by, absentee sort of owners. And there's been, I think it's challenging to see, to do anything about, number one. You don't know that. I think you'd run into some, not an attorney, but I think you'd run into some legal problems if you tried to bar sort of non-residents from
discrimination.
Yeah, from buying land, because, Louis just said, Louis owns land in, more than one county because of the geography of where he lives. So if I say you can't own land where you don't live, does that mean Louis can't own land in the county that he doesn't live in? Well, that would be ridiculous.
That brings me to one topic that has to do with property taxes, which is schools, which in all honesty, the portion that the county actually uses of your property taxes is not that much. But if you live in a town, the city and the school takes the majority.
Yeah, the general breakdown. Now it's not the same everywhere, but the general breakdown is usually, if you live in the county, or if you the county takes about 20%. If you live in a city, they take anywhere from roughly 30, and then the school district takes about 50.
Yeah, I think Linn County takes about 16%.
Yeah, so ballpark.
But two things. One, people don't realize the only jurisdiction that a county supervisor has is the rural area and the buildings that they own within a city or town. So I do think that you could limit what we spend money on by the jurisdiction that we actually have, possibly, or, dictate where it goes to a certain extent. And that's not necessarily going to lower your property taxes. It might raise your city taxes and lower your county taxes doing that. The second thing is, and you hit this, and definitely with schools, you can own land in several school districts, but you only get to vote in one.
Sure.
And so there are, and I don't know if that's a good idea or a bad idea. I have different people tell me, oh, that's terrible because you'll never vote for something in a different school district. Well, that's not necessarily true. I have grandkids that go to that school district and things like that. But I do think there are things that they could look at to actually lower. And the other thing is you have different boards that fall with, are they called quasi boards? Is that what they're called? Conservation board.
Yeah.
Their EMA board.
Yeah.
You could limit those boards and the control they have with the money that they're given by giving it back to the supervisors that you actually vote for.
Sure.
And that maybe wouldn't lower property taxes today, but sometimes lowering your property taxes today is limited in the future tax increases that they're going to come up with.
Sure. And you and I have had this conversation. I know that we disagree on this because I live in the city of Cedar Rapids. I still pay county taxes.
You do.
I don't get anything for my county
taxes.
That's
not true.
Well, you and I have had this conversation because—
And you're just mistaking about
it. The county doesn't fix the pothole in front of my street.
You're right. That's the city.
The county doesn't pick up my garbage.
That's true.
So unless I come out to visit you.
Let's be honest, though. You get your car licensed at the county office. We handle all your voting.
But you charge a fee.
All your voting.
But you charge a fee for the license.
The state charges a fee for the license.
And you get to keep some of it.
And we get to keep a very small portion of it. We take care of all your voting needs. And all those needs are taken care of through the county.
Okay.
At the auditor's office.
Yeah.
And so you do get something for that.
Yeah, I get. Okay, so for my county property taxes, I get to vote.
But let's face it, the majority of your taxes go to whatever school district you're in and the city. That's the majority. We just got done discussing that.
Sure.
Only 15% goes to the county.
Okay, so cut my taxes by 15%.
Well, then you wouldn't be paying for the voting services that you get or your car license. And you probably do use a county. Good point. You probably do use a county park.
I don't use a county park.
Well, you probably don't, Gary, but most people do. In fact, in Linn County, you're very fortunate if you do because we have parks that actually rival the state parks.
But I have plenty of city parks I could use if I wanted.
You can't camp in them, though. You can't camp in them, Gary. Well, you know, unfortunately, you can't always be right, Gary, and you're just on the wrong side of this one.
But I think, you know, going back to your premise, though, about, you know, can't you limit expenditures? Absolutely, the state could. The problem is where do you draw the line? Because, you know, each community has different priorities. So, and those priorities, I think, in my opinion, are best set by the people that I elect to set them. And those are my county board of supervisors and my city council and my mayor.
But right there, I agree 100% with you. So here we can actually agree in a roundabout way. If you limited what the county can levy for taxes for county use in their jurisdiction, you still have your city taxes. I'm not saying you limit that.
No, and I think that's what one of the goal of the legislature is to limit revenue growth over time. And I think the issue is that I think everybody one of the problems is that there aren't a lot of people that really understand property tax system. You get essentially three notices a year. Okay. You get a valuation notice, you get your first payment due in March, and you get your second payment due in September. So
when you get the third one that they just started making us.
Well, I think that comes,
which is a warning signal, I guess.
Yeah, and so I think what really confuses people is that first notice, because we all like it when our 401ks go up, but we don't like it when the value of our property goes up, because that, of course, most people think it triggers more taxes. But I think what happens is when you open your that first notice and you see, okay, the city or the county, whoever it is, says my house is worth $100,000 more than it was last year. And oh my God, that's the value I'm going to be paying. Well, not under our current property tax system, because first of all, you have to consider there's the rollback, which means your residential property and it changes every year, which is another confusing thing. It's set by the Department of Management, if I'm not mistaken. So I think currently you pay anywhere from about 49 to 51% of the value of your home. So if let's say your house is worth $100,000 and the rollback is 50%, then you'd be paying, you know, actual property taxes based on a valuation of 50% minus whatever other credits or exemptions, minus like a homestead exemption, you know, a veterans exemption.
So you brought up, you know, the issue with discrimination earlier. Yeah. You know, we already do this with exemptions, right?
Yeah.
So can we continue to expand that, or has there been any expansion of these exemptions?
Yes. Under the current iteration, you know, of the property tax bill, they do several things. They increase the veterans exemption. They increase the homestead exemption, I think, to $50,000. They increase the exemption for the over 65 based on whether or not they earn more than 350% of the federal poverty level. So a lot of those exemptions have been increased. So, but that doesn't make the system really any more or any less confusing.
Right.
So,
do you ever think Iowa would go to a sales tax and not do property tax anymore?
Well, I think that becomes very challenging because I know that there are more than a few legislators that probably wouldn't look favorably upon what they call a tax swap. So, unfortunately, you know, and a tax swap is simply just replacing one revenue stream with another. Then you run into things, and you know, bringing this back to agriculture for a little bit, for just a minute, there are lots of inputs into agricultural operations that are exempt from sales tax. One of the things, if you wanted to generate the kind of revenue that you'd need for to replace one tax with another, is you'd have to look at eliminating a lot of those exemptions. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure what the people that have the exemptions, I'm sure like them. I mean, they're good. They, you know, especially in tight years, which I'm not sure there's anything but a tight year, you know, in agriculture, at least anytime.
It's because our property taxes keep going up.
In the recent memory. Well, I don't think that's the only reason.
Not that.
But I think you'd have to take a look at eliminating lots of exemptions, and then you just run into a kind of a almost a game of whose ox are you going to gore.
But you could control it then.
Well,
to a certain extent.
Sure, you could control it to a certain extent now.
You can't control your property taxes.
Sure you can.
How? Not by property, obviously.
No, but, yeah, but buy a less buy a less expensive house. Well, you can control your property taxes, and this is one of the things that you know, kind of you take a look at where you're spending them. So Louis Zumbaugh is running for supervisor. He tells me he wants to cut my taxes. I vote for him, you know, and other supervisors, you know, if you want to control your property taxes, you probably ought to do that with your vote, which in my opinion is the most effective way to do it. But, and same with city councils, you know, if you don't like what they're spending on, I guess I'm a little more of a, you know, and to paraphrase some of our founding fathers, that government that governs closest to the people governs best.
But there's the exact reason where I was kind of going at why I don't believe county supervisors should be limited on what they can spend their money on. So if you come from a 5 or 3 person board, it can only be either one in Iowa.
Sure.
It doesn't matter. But just say we're the 3 supervisors and we have a fund that we can give to different things. I may really like NASCAR. You may really like horse racing and you may really like soccer. So we all want to give to some benefit group for something. Why not just not have a tax? Why not just take that money and not tax it in the first place? And people can spend their money where they want, their own personal money, instead of me deciding. And that could take away, you know, a few cents out of the millage rate.
Well, that's a decision they can make now.
But it is, but very, very few of them do because it's already in there.
Right.
If the state just said you can only tax for things that have to do with government and running the government, you'd take away them fringe things.
So if I guess my question would be then, if I'm having the state dictate, you know, how much they can levy and what they can spend it on, why do I need to pay you as a supervisor? Why do I need to pay your salary?
Well, maybe we don't.
Clearly, yeah, I don't need you because you're not really making any decisions. You're just sort of filling in blanks on a budget sheet.
Well, that's maybe I wouldn't go quite as far as you are, but that certainly could be a way of doing it.
Yeah. And well, and, you know, every now and again, you know, some brave soul will, you know, talk about things like consolidating counties, which, you know, consolidating, you know, school districts. And everybody who's not on the list of those who would be consolidated is probably thinks that's a better idea than the people who are. Because we went through this, not a similar thing, but you know, I think late 90s, early 2000s, when the post office was going through a reorganization,
sure,
big reorganization, and a lot of our small towns lost their post offices, you know, that had been there since the 30s. When you lose your post office and now you got to drive 10 miles or 20 miles if you got a P.O. box or if they deliver to your route. And it's, you know, the small town lost its post office 20 years ago. If we consolidate schools, they lose their high school football team. You know, if we consolidate counties, now Are we going to have a driver's license spot, place where you can renew your driver's license at the county seat? Can I still go get my license for my boat?
All things that you do at the county courthouse, correct?
Right.
And if you had a boat and you had whatever else you were just talking about, you would be getting benefit from paying your county taxes. Wanted to point that out to you, Gary.
But Louie, I'm not a farmer. I'm not rich enough to afford a boat, so.
I don't have a boat either.
So, Gary, we're on a good topic here, property taxes. You're a lobbyist. Tell our listeners, what you do as a lobbyist. How do you interact and move the pieces around? What do you do?
Well, first of all, it's a misnomer that, lobbyists move any pieces around. We kind of get sort of a bad reputation when you talk about lobbyists. Absolutely. I have clients that I advocate, for their interests. Most of what I do is provide information to legislators. So, if a proposal comes out, one of the things we'll do is we'll go back to our clients, our cities and our counties, and we'll say, okay, given this proposal, how would this affect us, going forward? What kind of budget sort of constraints does it look like? What parts of this do we think we can live with? What parts of this do we think are going to do, some long-term damage, if any? And then we'll bring that back to sort of the policymakers, and we'll say, okay, according to our clients, this is what's going to happen. This is what we anticipate happening, should something like this pass. So we don't really move around legislators. We just, they'll ask us for information, because, if you're doing something that affects somebody's budget, then, you go to that person and say, okay, we pass this tomorrow, what would happen? That's the kind of information. And, I think legislators appreciate that. There's no pushing around. Because we have a part-time legislature that doesn't have a lot of staff, there's a caucus staff that provide, input to them. There's the legislative service agency that will generate some supporting material, like something they call a fiscal note, like what a particular bill would cost or what the fiscal impact would be. And then there's the lobby that, because we're not necessarily experts, in every policy area that they discuss, but we generally know people who are. So we'll try to get the legislature the information that they need to make, I think, the best decision that they can. And they'll get information from, say I represent Linn County. I'll give them Linn County's perspective. They'll also get, perspective of groups like, Iowa Taxpayer Association, Iowans for Tax Relief, saying, giving them, other perspectives. So I think that's kind of the value we provide to the legislature. Some of them I'm sure get annoyed with us. I know Louie used to get annoyed with me on quite a regular basis, especially when I didn't agree with him. But I think they always appreciate somebody sort of, at least being devil's advocate, saying, look, if you do this, this is the most likely outcome of this. So if you go down this course, realize that, these things might happen, some of which are good, some of which may not be so good. Like earlier when we were referencing, I think it was House File 718, which is the last property tax change they did 2 years ago. I don't think it was certainly not the intent of the legislature to adversely affect smaller towns.
Right.
But I think that was one of the unintended consequences of it, that, when we say to legislators, this might happen, it turns out that it does happen. I think that's one of the reasons why they're moving so carefully this time, is that they're trying to minimize, and you can't do this 100%, but they're trying to minimize unintended consequences.
I know there's we could beat property taxes to death. I could talk about for 3 hours and we got other things we want to discuss, but I know growing up though, the equipment the county had and things like that was far from what they have today. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I don't think they should not have air conditioning in their truck or anything. I'm not going to go that far, but and every county is different. But I know for our county, we really want for nothing. And that's fortunate, sure, not only for our employees, but also the people of the county that they can have a county that can do that. Although I do think we probably charge a little heavy on the property taxes, but much of it comes from the schools and the town you live in. I had lots of calls when I was a supervisor, you know, why are my taxes so high? And I'd go down and get their tax form and sometimes stop at their house and go through it. And it really wasn't the county that was really the problem. It was often in the other two right. subjects. So let's, are you good with property taxes for now?
Yeah, I okay. wouldn't mind asking a question about TIF. If TIF yeah. is in your wheelhouse, you know, what are they looking at changing for TIF? And
well, that's a good question. Because TIF, tax increment financing, is one of the very few economic tools that cities have to kind of directly impact development. And for those that may not be familiar with tax increment financing, it's simply a way of, if I take a piece of property, you know, an empty lot, and the taxable value on that is $1,000. Let's say, so Louis comes to me and he says, I want to build a, you know, to the city. And he says, I want to build a shopping center on that piece of property. And the value of the shopping center is, you know, $15 million. So what Louis and I will do is we'll negotiate and we'll say, we won't say it's worth $15 million, but we'll say, okay, for tax purposes, it's going to be worth $7.5 million. So we'll agree on that figure. So we say that, okay, that X number of X, you know, dollars of property taxes are due now on a $1,000 lot. So when you at $7.5 million, this amount of property taxes will be due. So we expect, you know, over the course of 20 years that it will generate this much money. So we will do what they call a tax increment financing. We'll capture that value, generally issue like a bond on it for any street repairs or sewage upgrades that you know that need to happen so that people can get in and out of Louis Shopping Center. There'll be plenty of sewer and water. And then we'll say, and we'll provide you a property tax abatement of, you know, 20% or whatever it is. So over 20 years, you'll pay, you know, this you know, fewer taxes. When that agreement expires, you know, it'll be taxed at the whatever the value is assessed at then. So, but that does have ramifications on both county budgets and school budgets, because the foundation formula, all of the taxing jurisdictions' values are captured in there. So like the county property taxes and the school foundation levy are captured in there. So if the school's not getting that property tax, generally it's sort of backfilled by the state. So that kind of chaps the state a little bit because it does cost them some money. It chaps counties a little bit because, when that is taken off the tax rolls, or when that impact is lessened, then the county gets less revenue. So
that's really where they're only getting the less revenue on the thousand.
Well, they're getting the less revenue over time, over that 20 years. So the full valuation won't be realized until kind of the end of the agreement. So during the agreement, they're getting a lot less revenue, you know, out of that particular parcel. They may be getting a little more, but not sort of a lot more. This gets really complicated. That's why sometimes with these projects, I know this is real popular with like nonprofits, like the University of Iowa, when they build a giant building, you know, a hospital or something down there, or the medical clinics, they'll do what they call a pilot agreement or a payment in lieu of taxes. So they'll say, okay, our $40 million hospital, you know, would be taxed at, you know, $3 million a year. Will give you $500,000 or $1 million a year to be divided up between the taxing jurisdictions as kind of to make up for the property they're taking off, you know, kind of the property tax rolls. So it's really, and I think the state certainly, you know, there are folks in the legislature that certainly are not fans of tax increment financing, you know, and I think there's, some good reason to leave that in local control. It, like I said, it's kind of cities and counties don't really have a ton of money to incentivize businesses to move to their area. One of the things that they use is the tax increment financing to lessen the cost of building some of those developments, because, you know, the sewer, if Louis project costs $15 million, if he had to put sewer and water and the street leading up to it and some of that stuff, it may cost him $20 million. So I think that there's always talk about reforming or changing TIF, but I think also doing that, so doing whatever it is that you want to do that doesn't affect existing agreements, because sometimes there is debt associated with those. You know, they'll issue, the city will go out and kind of issue like a revenue bond or, you know, a TIF bond, you know, based on, you know, the expected revenue from this particular development. So the answer, that's a long answer to your question, is yes, everybody's always looking at that, but that's another thing I don't think they figured out quite yet.
So do you lobby on behalf of TIF, or what are some things that you've lobbied on that you've seen had success with your efforts?
Well, I lobby for local government. So a lot of what I do is like, unfortunately, stopping what we consider some bad things to from happening. Like, one of the things we like to preserve is, to the greatest extent possible, sort of local control. Like, there are folks in the legislature that, you know, do things like, they'll introduce bills that will restrict how we can zone certain things, that how we handle stormwater in development, runoff in developments, you know, kind of things like that. So we like to preserve local control as much as we can. And I know that, you know, this is why, you know, Louis and I disagree on this, you know, sort of the state regulating what the county can spend their money on, because, you know, in kind of our view, by not just my view, but my client's view, I think that individual counties are probably better suited to make decisions on what they can and, you know, should spend money on than somebody at the state legislature. Because, you know, you can't tell me that, and it would be really hard for you to convince me that a legislature in Des Moines is better qualified to tell the Delaware County Board of Supervisors what they shouldn't spend money on than, you know, the Delaware County taxpayers and voters.
But at the same time, when you're talking about development, you're most of the time, yeah, I don't know how little of the time it would be, you're talking about things that are inside a jurisdiction outside of the county supervisors.
Sure.
So once again, you could limit what the county supervisors can actually.
But there's no reason why it couldn't be, because
it would fall then on a city council.
Well, most of the time, but not always. And I think, you know, I was just having this conversation with a legislator today, you know, I think everybody benefits when, you know, all of our communities grow, not just Cedar Rapids.
I don't disagree with that.
Coggin, but when, let's say, you know, I'm the mayor of a town of 1,000 people. Okay, I get elected. How do I recruit a business? I mean, those aren't sort of natural things that lots of people know, unless you're in the business of doing that. So, like in Cedar Rapids, the mayor has, you know, our economic alliance. We have a development department, you know, in the city of Cedar Rapids. And these are professional people that know how to recruit business, how to put together incentive packages. Why aren't we, I guess my question to this particular legislator was, why aren't we talking more to small town mayors and small town city councils, you know, city managers where they are, city clerks where they aren't, and saying, okay, guys, you know, look, here's, you know, let's put them through a crash course of how to recruit a business. Because, and if you get somebody that's interested, how do I put together an incentive package to get this person to move to Coggin and not Manchester or Cedar Rapids?
Don't we already have that with like your local area economic development organization?
In a lot of areas, yes, but in some areas that they may not have an economic development arm that covers their particular area or their county. I know, I think our economic alliance covers like 7 counties in Eastern Iowa, if I'm not mistaken. And I apologize if I missed one or two, but for those that don't have, or maybe one of the things we teach them is, okay, so I'm the new mayor of whatever, you know, in Delaware County. The Metro Economic Alliance, you know, is one of the people that, you know, that will help you if you need help. But I think we may need to do a little bit more with some of our rural communities to talk to them about how do you grow a city.
And I'm not disagreeing with that, but all it goes back to what I just got done saying. None of that happens within the jurisdiction of the county itself.
I think we could do the same with county supervisors.
And so you could limit what the county can actually spend its money on. That I'm not saying you then don't have a city be able to do more. You just limit what the county's actually doing by what's done in their jurisdiction.
Yeah, and I don't think you and I are ever going to agree on this, Louis.
We're probably not.
Because I think the most effective limit on what counties spend their money on is their voters.
Fair enough. I would not disagree with that. However, I believe that everybody that lives in an incorporated area has their city council. And the only thing the rural people have is their supervisors.
Sure.
And therefore, I would go one step further if it was my fancy little world by itself and say that you have to be from the unincorporated area that you actually have jurisdiction over to represent it. But that's going way too far, and I don't want to start that argument.
No, that's right.
We've already spent a lot of time on that topic. Well, Gary, I want to thank you for coming out, and we spent most of the time on property taxes, but that's an important issue to everyone in the state, and thanks for coming out, and I hope that the audience rushes back for another episode of Rush Hour Ag.